This is side two of tape one. When the tape ended, we were talking about the first unionization efforts of the faculty.
Right. And I was asked to speak at those times, like to the faculty men's club, which eventually became the faculty club when they built their building and so on, about whether or not there would be unionization and so on. It was really very hotly debated from faculty who felt that unionization was the way to go and those who thought it was antithetical to a university and was the worst thing that could happen. As I said, I came on January of 72. By March of 72, the first efforts were starting to show petition for an election. And we had a meeting to set up the first vote. And interestingly enough, the person who showed up from the Michigan Education Association, who was the petitioner, had been the fellow that I had been sitting across the table from in Southfield when I was bargaining down there. By this time, he had moved to the Lansing area and was now the representative from Southfield. So the world came back together again.
Who was that?
Jim Sisson was his name. But this had been anticipated that this could all happen when Cliff created the position, because the petitioning and so on was going on at that time. So this was, it wasn't totally unexpected that there might be this effort. Anyhow, we agreed to set the election for that following October. And so the vote, and I can't give you the exact days, we're in October of 72. There was the normal information sharing as to what it meant, what the terminology meant, would people have to join unions, and so on. And we actually created, administratively, a process of putting out information, and the question at the time always was, how strongly an anti-position does the administration take? And there was the question at the time, the board was predominantly Democratic board members, democratically elected board members, and so there was always the question of how stridently could the university take an anti-union position? Should they take an anti-union position? There were clearly some within the administration who were very anti-union, but the position taken then and through the subsequent two elections that came later on was that the administration as a group should take an information position, should make sure that people were well informed, knew what the issues were, knew what the alternatives were, but that if there was going to be an anti-position, that was a kind of a freedom of speech issue, that an individual administrator wanting to speak out on it was free to do so, but that neither the president nor the administration as a whole would take a specific position.
What was Don Stevens' role on the board? Because his was, of course, a union background.
Yeah, well.
Did that enter into it at all?
Not really. Don Stevens and Pat Kerrigan, who were members of the board, were actually, I didn't know them personally, but they ended up being my champions as far as when I was brought to the board for this new position to be created and so on. They spoke on my behalf and so on. I found out later the reason for that. Of course, Don was very supportive of the School of Labor Industrial Relations, and I was coming from the School of Labor Industrial Relations. He had checked me out there, and I was fine there. Pat Kerrigan's was a little different story. As a faculty member, I had been appointed the fact finder in the dispute with the Ann Arbor schools and their teachers, and held hearings down there on their dispute over their contract. And Pat Kerrigan was working for the Ann Arbor Schools. And I didn't know her at the time or know anything about her, but found out later that she had been sitting in the front row throughout all these hearings watching me conduct these hearings and so on. And because of that, was impressed and became supportive, and to this day we're friends, you know. But they were the two who I, when my name was brought to the board, spoke on my behalf as, you know, why this was a good idea and so on. But when it came later on, and this has been true pretty much throughout all of the labor relations history here, the board has been cautioned to stay out of it. That's been difficult for some board members because of their own personal backgrounds and their own personal political connections and so on. But other board members have tended to remind them that they're in a management role when they're a board member, and that those of us who are hired to do this, we're professionals at doing it, and that while we should be accountable to them and make sure they understand what's going on and so on, that it would be best if they didn't address the press or speak on the issue. And that's been pretty much the way it's been for all of these years. They may, in private briefing sessions, express to us their opinion as to, you know, whether they thought we were taking the right tack or not, generally directing the president more than us who were doing the table work. But generally the board has stayed out of all of these things. And even when we've had strikes and the unions have come to the board, open board meetings, and, you know, spoke, and we've had pickets at the board meetings and so on, the board members have kept their comments generally in private session.
What were some of the in the late 60s, early 70s, what were some of the main issues, that labor issues,
well,
that you dealt with?
Yeah.
Besides, beyond just the mere organization and that sort of thing.
Well, of course, we were having there was a huge shift in the administrative style at Michigan State between John Hanna and then subsequent. John Hanna, I didn't work with John directly. I did work with Jack Breslin, who was John Hanna protege. Mm-hmm. And John Hanna was far more a directive, take control and give orders type president. The university was shifting from a college to a university from with a different kind of faculty who expected a different kind of academic governance. And Cliff came in, and there was a shift, and it continued to shift over the years to a much more collegial kind of academic governance. And there was this pull and tug between whether or not you were going to have this collegial kind of government, or you're going to have a collective bargaining kind of government. One of the classics was at Central Michigan, where they voted for unionization, but they wanted to still have academic governance, and so the issue there became which issues could academic governance deal with instead of collective bargaining. And that was part of the debate that went on here. Would academic governance lose its power to a union if there was unionization? There was a real clear split, and always has been, between the faculties of the various colleges as to who supported collective bargaining and who didn't. College of Arts and Letters had more support among its faculty for the collective bargaining than did the sciences, the hard sciences areas, the chemical, biological, physical science areas, engineering, business, were not as supportive. Other schools, such as education, tended toward supporting collective bargaining, but again, where there was more split. You could almost line up the colleges, and if you looked at things like salaries, the colleges that were had lower salaries by comparison tended to support the collective bargaining. There was also issues of resources like graduate assistantships and all the other resources that go along with supporting the teaching effort that were issues that kept coming up. But to characterize it kind of crassly, it was more the have and the have-nots kind of split. The other issue that came in there is that whether or not this was to be an MEA or a Teacher Education Association type of effort, and or whether it was to be an AAUP type of effort. And the first election, it was driven by an MEA supported group. It was later in the other elections, the later elections, that AUP actually came more forward. AUP was a part of the first election, but under Michigan labor law, you have to have a petition signed by 30% of the bargaining unit that you're seeking in order to get an election. But you can get on the ballot if you have a petition signed by 10%. And the same person can sign both ballots, both petitions or cards, if you will. So AUP got on with a 10% showing the first time. Oakland University, who had been attached to Michigan State not many years prior to this, had gone unionization with the AUP. And I think that had some influence. But there was the people who wanted no union were clearly trying to say that this was a research university in a class with the University of Michigan and other Big Ten research universities, and that research universities were not unionizing, which was basically true. The places where research universities were unionizing were in systems, like in Florida. The University of Florida and Florida State are in unionization, but all the system is, they're a part of a whole system. Same thing is true in New York, where the whole system is unionized, and so Stony Brook and others are part of that whole system. But many of your standalone research universities were not unionizing, and so Michigan State was trying to go through this transition of becoming recognized as a true research university and wanting to continue to be a part of that group and not the other group, as in the view of those who were speaking against it. There was a defeat of the union effort in the fall of 72. It has come up twice since, and I can't give you the exact dates. I believe the last one was 83, but I can't remember what the other middle one was. But in each case, the vote against unionization was greater than the time before. So as the years went by, the sentiment of not needing a union went up. I would say, from my observation, so did the strength of academic governance at the same time, that there was there's a real correlation between how academic governance has functioned and how the administration and particularly the provost and president have utilized and worked with academic governance over this same period of time. So I think for many faculty there wasn't a need for the collective bargaining if you had what they perceived as a governance system that worked.
Mm-hmm. Within your school, the School of Labor and Industrial Relations, was mm-hmm. there that same split?
Mm-mm. No. Not really. Most of the people in the School of Labor and Industrial Relations are ones who believe in the value of collective bargaining, okay? I think virtually all of them do. And the people who are working directly with management, as opposed to the division in the school labor industrial relations, there's a division that works with labor, and there's a division that works mostly with management, and then there's an academic program that teaches. And there's some overlapping. But the people working with management, you're really talking about two, three people. I mean, you're talking about huge numbers of people. And those would be people like myself who had a union background, who really saw it as a method of making decisions. And that if you didn't have a method that worked for the good of the employee in making decisions in the workplace, then collective bargaining was a good one, okay? But it isn't the only one. And, you know, as I teach in my collective bargaining courses today, that management creates unions, unions don't create unions, mm-hmm. and that if management works with employees, listens to employees, takes into concern the needs of employees, you're probably not going to have a union. But that if management runs roughshod over employees and doesn't involve them and keep them connected with the work of the organization, then the employees are probably going to form a union. Now, once formed, they tend to stay. They, even though we've had a shrink in unionization, the shrinkage has come not because they voted out unions, it's because those companies have gone away. Mm-hmm. And new companies have come in who haven't unionized.
Mm-hmm. In looking back at some of those early years, the attempts at faculty unionization, who were some of the people you faced across the table? Do you remember any of the leaders?
Well, I remember Phil Korth was probably the main leader on the faculty side. Phil believed strongly that this was the way that the faculty should go for representational purposes, that this was a better system than governance. Phil had, as I understood it, had a labor history background, and this was his belief. We never really had any major problems in discussion. I mean, it was very collegial, even in setting up elections and so on. It was really a test of philosophies as to whether or not one system of decision making was better than another system, or one system of governance was better than another. And that was, I think, far more the case with the faculty unionizations than it might have been with some of the staff unionizations. It was really a clash of philosophies and where was the power going to come from? Whether there should, I think there was a real strong feeling that there needed to be a better balancing of power and in decision making and distribution of the fruits of labor across the faculty, that the distinctions in salaries were too broad, that and that there should be more of a homogenization, if you will, of salary mm-hmm. levels and so on across disciplines. That's probably here today. I don't think that goes away. But it's an issue of whether or not there is the power within the groups, of, if you back to the haves and the have-nots, if there's the power there to really exercise the clout to make this happen. One of the things that happens with unionizations, whether it's faculty unionization or any others, is you get a rising of the boats, if you will, so that there is less disparity between the lower paid and the higher paid than you would have if you simply look in the marketplace. And at the moment, without a union, and we're marketplace driven, more on salaries, where with unionization, you're more internally driven as far as your comparisons.
If one of the goals of the faculty union and those that supported it, like Phil Korth, was to increase faculty salaries. Was that an outgrowth of the defeat of the unionization? Did the salaries rise?
I don't think that all the way along for all of the years, we've had to work very carefully to keep the salary increase percentages among the staff and the faculty pretty close. If one got 3%, the other got 3%, if you will. Now, the difference might have been in the distribution methods, one being done on a merit system, the other being done across the board, for instance. But understand that when you're applying percentages against different bases, they generate very different outcomes. Mm-hmm. And so while the faculty might have gotten the same percentage, the average salary of a faculty member was probably twice the average salary of a clerical employee. So the percentage would generate considerably more dollars. The other thing that happened with more with the faculty than with not with the unionized employees is that there were a lot of special adjustments. When I first came on the administration, every special adjustment of every salary of every faculty member or every administrative professional employee had to go to the board. So every month we had these huge reports that made, I mean, if you adjusted somebody's salary by $25, it had to go to the board for approval. As a result, it had a real dampening effect on doing those kind of special adjustments. Over the years, that delegation of authority to the administration to manage inside the budget, in other words, the board passed the budget, but the administration could make these kind of adjustments, and they simply became reported to the board as a board report as opposed to board action, mm-hmm. Changed. And in fact, at one point in the late 70s, we stopped even doing the individual report on administrative professional employees to the board and didn't even report it. As long as we worked within budget of the university, the administrator was free to make adjustments and so on. As a result, you started to get far more offline adjustments to meet market, to meet competitive offers from other places and so on. And so it became much more difficult to say what was the raise this year. The raise this year was the result of all of this that happened after the end of the year. You know, that made budgeting at the budget office level much more difficult because they worked from fixed numbers. They worked from one July to the next July. If adjustments had been made in the meantime, the unit had to figure out how they were going to move that money around and make those adjustments, but there was much more freedom to make those adjustments. We used to be very tightly budgeted in an equipment budget, a supplies and services budget, a salary budget, a labor budget, and monies couldn't cross those lines. Well, the first thing they did is fold the supplies and equipment and the supplies and services and the equipment budget into one budget and so on. And there got to be much more flow, and administrators were allowed to manage their budgets more freely. So you started to get more of the adjustments. Also, there became a system of recognizing equity adjustments, particularly adjustments to female faculty salaries and so on. So that a lot of the things that had become embedded that were the points upon which you could make an argument for unionization started getting taken care of, mm-hmm. on a case-by-case basis over time. And I think that took a lot of the pressure off. The other thing is that by keeping the faculty and the unions pretty closely together, it was hard for someone to argue that, see, the unions are doing so much better than we are, we should unionize also, because that wasn't happening. And this was particularly true on the benefits side. We kept everybody together on the benefits programs, so that if benefits improved for one, improved for all.
Did you have any model that you used for the faculty benefits? Was it the union?
Well, it was all one pool, even to this day, what's done is to work with the Faculty Affairs Committee, who has a subcommittee on benefits. Mm-hmm. We have now, for the first time in the last couple of years now, there is a slight difference between the direction of the benefits for faculty and the benefits for the staff unionized employees. But that was done with the recommendation of the Faculty Affairs Committee. I mean, that was the difference is that the faculty pays a little more for premium on their health care, but for that they got a bigger percentage on their salary increases, where the unions chose to go the different direction and they wanted no premium pay and they took less on their salary increases. But it was done in conjunction with the representatives, with the Faculty Affairs Committee becoming clearly more and more the clear representational line that the provost works with. But they've, you know, the coverages are almost exactly the same. It's only the difference in how they're paid for that has changed. And that, I think, will probably stay together for a number of reasons. It'll stay together. For one reason, by keeping them all together, you have more leverage in the market, and you can insure across a broader group, so you mm-hmm. you can handle the ups and downs of catastrophic things that happen within one group and not in the other group. Mm-hmm. The other thing that happened in 1973 or four, I can't give you any, we had another big strike. We'd had a strike of the maintenance and skilled trades employees. I think it was 69. That was before I was on the faculty, but I was not in the administration. And I was then in the administration in 72, and I think it was 73 that we had another big strike. And that strike, I think, went on for 10 days. But some things happened as a part of that strike that I think really made even a greater influence among many faculty to be anti-unionization. One thing that happened is there was sabotage in some of the animal labs. Animals were let out of their cages, and there was whole research projects that were destroyed because of the intermixing of animals that had been under research in research groups and that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. Some of that kind of violence, I think, really solidified those who didn't want to have or be a part of a union situation.
Especially in the sciences?
Yeah, mm-hmm. particularly in the sciences. We still continued to have strikes, you know, periodically. But the last major strike was with the clerical employees. And again, I can't give you the exact date, but that was it was going to occur at the opening of school, and we had developed a strike contingency plan to open school, run without them being able to interfere with the opening of school. The strike that happened in the late 60s actually, and I think Walter Adams was president at the time, actually delayed the opening of school by a day or two. But there was this resolve that this wasn't going to happen again. Of course, the clerical union, figuring that they had, this was their huge time of clout because with all the registration process. Anyhow, the gear up was such that we had this wide cross-campus planning group that was to plan the contingencies against this. And what happened is students went through registration, came out the backside, television cameras in their face, and students saying this is the best registration they'd been through. And 2 days later, the strike settled, you know, and stopped. And we really haven't had, you know, a big effort since then. We've had some threats and so on, but the whole idea that going out, striking, or locking out employees, or whatever, was going to solve anything, became clear wasn't going to solve anything. Mm-hmm. That we really needed a new kind of labor relations, which was more collaborative. And for the last 10, 15 years, that's really been the model of the labor relations, a much more ongoing, day-to-day, collaborative, meeting on a regular basis, dealing with issues as they come up. Same thing's true in the relationship